Then it's time for the third and final section of this lecture, where we will take a closer look at the democratic and political challenges that faces India today. When Indian democracy turned 70 in 2017, this was celebrated and formal democracy was in many ways live and kicking. As I've mentioned, people in India have a strong dedication to democracy as a form of government, as we can see in the high levels of electoral turnout. At the same time, India, like many other countries in the world, has recently seen a development towards authoritarian populism fronted by a so-called strong leader. In 2014, the Bharatiya Janata Party ran a highly person-centered election campaign. They projected Narendra Modi, their prime ministerial candidate, as a development man. He literally campaigned on a promise to make India great again. Modi's legitimacy as a development man came from the Gujarat model of development. Before becoming prime minister in 2014, Narendra Modi had concluded three consecutive terms as chief minister of Gujarat, an Indian state, where he had focused on building world-class infrastructure, roads, electricity, water, on attracting foreign investment, and on technological advances. So this model has resulted in high economic growth rates, but a closer look shows that the state is performing relatively poorly on other indicators if we compare it to other developed Indian states, like the educational levels of women and child mortality. Narendra Modi also nurtures a close relationship with the top tier of the Indian business elite, who have embraced his vision for the country. And so they have also supported the BJP with very generous amounts of campaign funds. And this was a crucial contribution to the party's success in 2014. What Modi and the BJP presented in 2014 was also a vision for the future, that of a high-tech India. During the campaign, one of the most revolutionary things that they did was to broadcast Modi's speeches from his electoral rallies in 3D hologram projections inside trucks like the one you can see here, so that his speeches could be witnessed in person. Also in smaller towns and villages. But Narendra Modi is not only about development and technology. He is also a strongman politician, known to speak in election rallies about his 56-inch chest. He's seen as a determined decision maker who has maintained a hard line against Pakistan and on the question of Muslim refugees from Bangladesh and on those who are construed as internal enemies. And Modi was also chief minister of Gujarat in 2002 when there were large-scale pogroms in the state, where thousands of Muslims were murdered. And this was a crucial element, I would say, in the making of Narendra Modi as a politician. Now, Hindu nationalism, which we've seen which has emerged more clearly after the coming of the BJP government, entails a Hinduization of society through history writing, through the school system. And the BJP is quite occupied with telling the story of how India is and has always been a great nation. In the previous section, I talked about the Ram Janmabhoomi campaign and the tearing down of the mosque in Ayodhya in 1992. Now, what was this campaign and this moment really about? I would say it was a contestation of the idea of India and also about what the majority in a democracy is allowed to do or has the right to do against the minority group. The campaign was a tool to politicize religion, that is, to take a religious majority, the Hindus, and make a political majority out of that group. The Hindutva ideology sees Hinduism and Hindu culture as the basis of the Indian nation, and religious minorities, especially Muslims and Christians, are defined as the nation's other and as an inherent threat. When we speak of Hindutva or Hindu nationalism, this is not merely referring to the BJP, but to a much wider movement with many different kinds of organizations that reach into almost every sphere of life. Schools, youth organizations for men and for women, a farmers' union, a labor union, a women's wing, and international organizations working with Indian diaspora communities. Now, the umbrella under which these organizations are organized is referred to as the Sangh Parivar, the family of organizations. And most central in this family is the RSS, the National Volunteer Organization, which is a right-wing Hindu nationalist paramilitary organization that was founded in 1925. So this ideology was formulated in the early 20th century in dialogue with and partly inspired by fascist movements in Europe. According to this ideology, India should not be a secular state, but a Hindu nation. And according to this line of thinking, Indians are those who consider India not only their motherland, meaning that they are born there, but also their holy land. Religions that originated outside of India are seen as essentially foreign. Sikhism, Buddhism, Jainism all originated in the subcontinent, and they are thus considered part of the Hindu tradition, while Christianity and Islam are considered foreign religions, and their followers are also, in a sense, foreign. Now, this, of course, totally disregards that Christianity has been present in the subcontinent probably since the 1st or 2nd century AD, and Islam since the 7th century. So there are hundreds of years of tradition where these religions have existed in the subcontinent. That is just sidelined, you might say. Now, one of the ways in which this ideology is visible in Indian politics today relates to Indian self-images and soft power. The vision is that India is a great spiritual power and it has a desire to regain the greatness of an imagined past. And so what is being promoted? It's yoga, it's Bollywood, the cultural heritage of the country, tourism, and so on. The Modi-led government has been particularly active in promoting yoga as an Indian spiritual gift to the world. And in 2015, the UN recognized the International Day of Yoga, and it has been celebrated since on June 24th. And this is an image from the celebration in Norway in 2015. Now, of course, everyone loves yoga, but the state promotion of these benevolent cultural goods also has another side. When yoga and vegetarianism are equated with India and displayed as the cultural features that characterize the nation, this also contributes to defining other practices as un-Indian. In particular, the anti-Muslim rhetoric has been ugly over the past 7 years, and this has gone hand in hand with physical violent attacks on Muslims, on Muslim ways of life in their religious places, and on their livelihoods. In February 2020, many Muslims were killed and even more displaced from their homes in New Delhi when they became victims of targeted attacks by Hindu nationalist mobs. What is particularly worrying is that the police and the local government did little to prevent these attacks, despite receiving hundreds of emergency calls. And in some instances, the police were even found to side with the attackers. The emphasis on vegetarianism is related to the sacredness of the cow, which is worshipped by Hindus as a mother goddess. This has resulted in several states introducing bans, total bans on cow slaughter, and the closing of slaughterhouses, something that destroys the livelihoods of those who work within meat production. Vigilante groups have targeted and lynched truck drivers, often on the mere suspicion that they are transporting cows for slaughter. And jobs in this sector are almost solely staffed by Muslims and Dalits. And since 2014, the number of such deadly attacks have increased sharply. This Hindu-based vision of the future, of which Modi is the foremost representative, goes hand in hand with neoliberal economic policies and with India's aspirations as a future global superpower. Since the re-election of the BJP in the spring of 2019, we've witnessed even stronger nationalist currents, gross violations of civil rights, and increasingly authoritarian clampdown on voices of protest and dissent. There have been more systematic attacks on the rights of minorities, and especially Muslims. There is also a tendency to centralize power so that weight of politics is beginning to shift again from the states and back to the center. And there are also indicators that central institutions, also highly esteemed institutions like the Supreme Court and the Election Commission, are becoming politicized, that they are under political influence. And importantly, since 2013, in terms of during election campaigns, but also in between elections, Narendra Modi and the BJP have acquired a very strong dominance of the Indian media, both traditional media, newspapers and TV channels, but also social media. And all of this is enabled by the great financial resources that they have access to. Now, are there opposing forces? Are there other narratives? Well, low caste and Bahujan politics continue to be an important force, but electorally it is now severely on the back foot. However, there have been several rounds of protest coming out of Indian universities. And in the winter of 2019-2020, there were large-scale protests across the country, many of them led by Muslim women, against a proposed amendment of citizenship laws. Now, these protests were part of what was targeted in the violence in Delhi in February 2020. And not long after these attacks, there was the advent of the coronavirus, which abruptly ended these large-scale public protests. So there has been an occasional tendency that students, the traditional left, low-caste activists, and activists from the women's movement have come together. But these coalitions so far have not translated into proper electoral alternatives. So right now, I would say the only person who could bring Narendra Modi down in India is Narendra Modi himself. If he fails to fulfill the electoral promises that he has given, and if he sort of does something or does not do something that results in him falling from grace. What will the future bring? India has a strong population growth and has had a strong economic growth, as we've seen in recent decades, which means that it will be one of the most powerful countries in the world in a decade or two. If we look a little closer at this economic development, what do we find? And I'm generally not so keen on predicting the future because it's so easy to make mistakes. But fortunately, there are others who do this. For example, the International Monetary Fund. Now, you have to note immediately that the graph on your left is a prediction. So this is not based on actual figures, but from 2020 onwards, these are projected figures. But of course, the graph looks very much optimistic. And the graph to the right, on the other hand, shows the quarterly GDP numbers since 2011. And here we see also the considerable economic setback that the corona pandemic has caused. I will also say that numbers show, particularly in the last decade, that economic growth has led to a sharp reduction in what is defined as extreme poverty. And this is celebrated, of course, in Indian news media. However, the economic threshold that is set to define this category is extremely low, which gives us reason to be somewhat critical of these statistics. Now, one thing that we can say about India's economic growth is that it has led to increasing economic inequality. And here I want to point to two worrying developments. The first is how wealth is distributed in the population. In 2018, the richest 1% of the population owned 53% of all assets and wealth in the country. If we expand that to the richest 10%, they owned as much as 76.3% of the total wealth. And a survey from 2015 found that India now has more billionaires than Switzerland, Hong Kong, and France combined. The second worrying development is how wealth is distributed geographically. This map is based on recent figure for 2019-2020, and the states are colored according to their GDP, where lighter color indicates a lower GDP and darker color illustrates a higher GDP. And as you can see, there are great regional differences. Now, this map is based on the same figures, but show states with a GDP that is higher than the national average as red, and states with a GDP that is lower than the national average as white. And so here, the north-south regional difference becomes very clear. These differences in value production are further accentuated by the fact that many of the most populous states in the country lie in this belt across northern India from west to east. So if one takes the population into account, which has been done here, the differences become even more pronounced. What we see here is GDP per capita, that is the annual income and production value of the state divided by the number of people living there. Conventional economic theory would tell us that when you have the condition of economic growth, poor areas tend to grow fastest, and in that way, geographical differences will be evened out. In contemporary India, the difference in average per capita income between states is increasing, not decreasing. So there are welfare programs, job guarantees, etc., but these do not seem to reach those people and those areas that need them the most. And the same goes for tax breaks and subsidies, which produce the greatest return for those with higher incomes. Moreover, currently, there is no political will to change this development. And so this is an issue that can potentially become a reason for political unrest and instability in the future. And then there's Corona. How has the global pandemic affected India? More than 9.5 million people have been registered as infected, and 139,000 people have died from the coronavirus in early December 2020. This graph shows daily occurrences, and as you can see, the peak was here in towards the end of September. Now, there's great uncertainty related to these numbers in many places in the world, but even more so in India. In many areas, people have limited access to health services, and the country has had challenges related to test capacity. There is also a social stigma related to getting the virus, so that people with symptoms may not get tested because they would fear for the results. If we look at these figures comparatively, now you see India's graph, the purple towards the bottom, looks much less threatening. It appears quite clearly that regardless of how accurate we think the numbers are, that India has been able to turn the tide. Now, how this will end and what consequences it will have for India's economy and overall development in the future, I think, remains an open question. So I will attempt to summarize what we have been discussing today. We started off discussing the inheritance of the independence movement in independent India. The young nation inherited institutions both from the British Raj and from the independence movement as such. There was a strong dedication to democratic ideals that became crucial in founding Indian democracy. In the 1950s and 1960s, this was the era of Congress dominance and Nehruvian socialism. It was a period characterized by stability and seeming political unity, at least on the national level, because most of political strife and negotiations occurred within the Congress party and not from opposition parties outside. We had state-led, top-down industrialization and development. And as we have discussed, the combination of socialist rhetoric with conservative realpolitik. The 1970s was a period of economic stagnation, which led to protests and political turbulence. And the response from the government, then led by Indira Gandhi, was a form of left populism and related processes of institutional decay. The emergency of 1975 to 1977 till date represent the deepest crisis that Indian democracy has faced. But post-emergency, democracy was re-established, which was a great accomplishment. However, the aftermath saw increased party fragmentation and clearly the end of the Congress era in Indian politics. In the 1980s until the year 2000, party fragmentation continues, and we see increasing antagonism and rivalry between different regional interests, between different castes and social strata, and between religious groups. However, this development also involved a democratic deepening and the inclusion of new groups into the political process, with the result that Indian democracy became more representative. From the 1990s until 2014, the Congress and the BJP have alternated in power in New Delhi, but both have led governments that have been broad coalition governments, including many smaller parties with differing political ideologies. And the political and the policy outcome of this has been a lot of negotiation and balancing between these different views. And so the states emerged as the fundamental political entity. In the northern large and populous states, politics in this era was dominated by Dalit and low-caste mobilization and counter-mobilization against this mobilization from below. While in the southern states, regional parties drawing upon a Dravidian identity movement have dominated politics in this period. In 2014, we get the return of a strong majority government at the center for the first time in decades. The promotion of Hindu nationalism produces conflicts and debates on what India is and what India should be. There is currently serious concern for the state of democracy in India on the question of minority rights, on the increasingly authoritarian handling of dissent and protest, and there is also the centralization of power, the undermining or at least politicization of central institutions, and the issue of media dominance. Finally, then, what can we say about the state of Indian democracy today? India has high levels of electoral participation, and the representativity of its democratic institutions on national and state levels has improved over the past decades. It has strong institutions, although there are developments that give reason for concern also in this area. The economy is growing, but so is economic inequality. And perhaps the most worrying development over the past 7 years has been the issue of minority rights. And I would like to end just with a note to say that in the protests that have occurred over the past 6 years, the Indian constitution has been used to powerfully contest the various anti-democratic policies of the government. And so in these protests, it is not Gandhi, but Bhimrao Ambedkar, who is a Dalit icon and considered to be the father of the Indian constitution, who has emerged as a possible unifying symbol for those many Indians who are unhappy with the direction that their country has taken recently. Thank you for your attention. And if you have questions to me or comments to the lecture, please feel free to write to me at the email address here.